In his first presidential campaign, President Reagan declared that government is the problem. The charge stuck, and ever since then, the leaders of both parties have barely questioned that assumption. But that might be changing now. In his latest book, The Case of Big Government, Jeff Madrick argues that voters shouldn't see big government as such a scary thing after all. Mr. Madrick is the editor of Challenge magazine, a senior fellow at the New School Schwartz Center for Economic Policy Analysis, and his book is published by Princeton University Press. I'm very pleased. It brings Jeff Madrick back to the show today. It's a pleasure to see you.
Thank you.
And you wrote this before even George Bush changed his mind somewhat about big government.
Yeah.
But it took a major economic crisis to change some people's minds.
Yeah, that's not unusual. You know, Milton Friedman wrote about this. He believed it was an economic crisis that brought his own ideas into ascendancy in the 1970s. He wrote about that in 1982, actually. I believe this for a long time. Government is an integral part of our society, both in terms of social justice and in terms of creating the conditions of prosperity.
But we have this debate over the stimulus package, which indicates that some are not yet convinced.
I think there's this ongoing battle, and my book addresses this first. Are tax cuts always good for the economy? Is government spending always bad for the economy? And I look at the evidence, cross-country evidence, by, I think, neutral, serious, scholarly observers, not particularly progressive economists. And the evidence is clear. Big government and high taxes has no correlation with economic growth, productivity, and so forth. The question now, I think, is not so much a question of stimulus as it is tax cuts versus government spending.
Well, President Obama has proposed tax cuts. Republicans in Congress are saying, that's fine, but we need even more. And you're suggesting that we don't need any tax cuts?
Yeah, I don't think we need any tax cuts. I think President Obama, and I'm still practicing saying that, President Obama is probably going to get rolled by the Republicans, as the Democrats have for a while. Maybe he'll learn. Maybe I'm wrong. He seems to want to compromise with them. I think the compromise could have been much smaller.
But why are people like you and Paul Krugman against tax cuts? The argument is that there are other ways to get bigger bangs for the buck?
Well, there are, especially now. People, if they get tax cuts, are not going to spend the money. They're going to save the money. The economy needs spending. But that's only one reason. The other reason is we have neglected public goods, social public investment for so long. We have so much to do that we can't afford tax cuts, especially going into the future.
Would you like to see tax increases?
I would after a time, after we get past this crisis. It's not even a crisis. It's
would
a
it
state
be,
of emergency.
Would it be reversing the Bush tax cuts, or would you like to see something different?
I'd like to see even more than that. I think we have to raise federal spending as a proportion of GDP by 3 or 4%. I want to make clear how moderate that is. That still leaves us 10, 12, 15 percentage points below the proportion of government spending there is in prosperous European nations.
Well, you said that people just save the money that they got on tax cut, but haven't we been hearing the arguments for saving money for a long time?
Yeah.
Americans don't save enough money?
It's a hard thing for people to grasp, I think, and a hard thing for economists to distinguish. Over the long run, Americans should be saving more money. In the very short run, a sudden increase in savings, which we are now undergoing, will remove demand for goods and services, spending so rapidly from the economy that there will be all kinds of what economists call negative feedback effects, reinforcing repercussions that could lead to an extremely severe recession.
Even before the economic meltdown, President Bush grew the size of government at a rate that has been unseen since the Great Society. So is it a matter of growing the government, or what parts of the government that you grow that's important?
Not at all is it a matter of growing the government. Big government doesn't automatically mean prosperity. It means needed social programs that are well managed. growing the defense budget, by and large, does not contribute to the long-term growth of the U.S. economy. But spending on infrastructure, spending on pre-K education, revamping, reforming the healthcare system, which is really a travesty in this country, all of that will give us a long-term foundation for more rapid growth.
So a better title of this book might have been The Case for Pragmatic Government, although you probably wouldn't have sold as many books.
Well, that could be, but it's about the purpose of government, and it's about getting over this mythology that big government itself is a bad phrase. Clinton used it as well, and so have many Democrats. We have to get over that idea. There's no such thing as a prosperous economy in the world without a fairly big government. No example in the world today.
And you write that change requires government, good government, surely, but there's no good government without faith in government itself. And
yeah.
And have all this talk undermined our sense of faith? And haven't we had some good cause to be suspicious of government at times?
Well, I think, you know, government can get carried away with itself. Not all government programs are good. Not all government leaders are good. But we went very far in the opposite direction, and very quickly, I might add. We put a lot of people in charge of programs in government who really dislike government, who wanted to see government fail or cut back seriously on it. When you don't have good people in charge, you undermine the capacity and efficiency of that thing.
And you say that activist government is something that we've seen in this country since pretty much the beginnings of the country.
Yeah, one of our many, many mythologies about government is that once upon a time we were a completely laissez-faire society. Jefferson not only who is the great, allegedly, ideologically laissez-faire president, not only bought the Louisiana territories and doubled the size of the country despite Congress's reservations. He also demanded all along in his career serious regulations about the sale of those lands. He didn't want it left to the market. That's just one example of many, many examples. The building of the canals, the building of the primary schools, the building of sanitation and sewage systems, the subsidies for land-grant universities, you know the list, and the railroads, of course.
So why do you think the mythology of laissez-faire, as you call it, has persisted?
I think to some degree we've always had that mythology, in part because land was We've always had some notion that less government is good because we broke away from a strong government. That's the foundation of our country. We also had lots of land available, which made people very independent. More than half of our colonialists and early Americans actually owned their own land, a stark reversal from experience in the old world. But we knew and learned pragmatically to use government because we needed it. And that's when we were best.
And you say the most prosperous period in America is when we use big government?
I think the period in which we dealt with our problems and created a commercial market was when we used government most effectively. Did we always? No. But when we abandoned government, and we've had other periods of anti-government attitude, we've paid a price for it.
Well, the 25 years after World War II were boom years, weren't they?
For sure.
And that was both Democratic and Republican presidencies?
Yeah, under Eisenhower, under Kennedy and Johnson, under Truman before Eisenhower. They were extraordinary boom years and years of very high income tax rates.
Well, we also had the Cold War stimulating our economy. We don't have anything like that today.
I'm not so sure. It seems some people are arguing it's coming back. And certainly we have a hot war in Iraq. But we did have something that some people call militant Keynesianism, a heck of a lot of defense spending in that period. But it worked. While it wouldn't be my choice to stimulate and keep an economy growing, it did work to add prosperity to the nation in those years when we were under capacity.
I don't understand how higher taxes can increase productivity.
Productivity is not just a function of government spending or tax rates. Productivity is a function of government programs that enhance education, that enhance our state of health, that start to develop in these times in particular, pre-K, that enhance our infrastructure, transportation, and high technology infrastructure are extremely important to commerce.
Right now there's a big debate over how to approach the infrastructure in this new stimulus package, whether we do things that can be worked on immediately so that we get the economy going quickly, or whether we should start thinking in terms of long-range big projects like high-speed rail and such.
I'm a longer-term infrastructure person. I think this rush to get the stimulus out, supported by both the Obama economics team and other economists, is a little bit is naive and probably not even good economics. We have to worry about the medium and longer run, I think. And we have, and when we spend, we have to spend well, and that will take some time working out these infrastructure programs. So I think the stimulus program, in terms of size, is correct. I think we have to do it carefully. And the most important thing I think Obama has to demonstrate to the American people is that government does work.
My guest is Jeff Madrick, who is a former economics columnist for The New York Times, a regular contributor to The New York Review of Books, and the editor of Challenge magazine, also a senior fellow at the New School. His book, The Case for Big Government, is published by Princeton University Press. You mentioned Milton Friedman. How important is he to current economic policy?
Well, fortunately, from my point of view, he's becoming less important. He was very important, I think. First of all, he was an enormously articulate man, extremely able to handle himself both verbally and in the written language. He was well respected in theoretical circles, I think, myself, for somewhat dubious reasons. But he ascended, he gave substance to this new ideology. It's not so much that suddenly people realize, hey, this idea is right, but they people inclined in that direction, like Bill Simon or Alan Greenspan in the 70s, and of course Ronald Reagan, had something to grab onto. So in those formative years when the country's attitudes turned so sharply, Friedman's ideas were extremely important to that movement.
And President Reagan was able to translate and sell his theories quite effectively. Do you think that President Obama will have to translate a new economic orthodoxy?
No, I don't think Obama is so theoretically oriented. And you know, I put it a little bit differently about Friedman and Reagan. Reagan had those views before he read. Reagan turned in the early 1950s before he read Friedman, or before Friedman was really writing popular stuff. He was beginning to do serious academic stuff. Reagan found the person who he thought could prove his point, and he did learn in turn from Friedman. I think Obama has already subsumed the theory that's around. I think he'll be too cautious, but I think he's by and large a pragmatist, and that's the good news.
Well, people have invoked FDR's New Deal and President Johnson's Great Society when they're talking about the kinds of social programs and work projects that President Obama could introduce. And we've been hearing that he's been reading all about history and in thinking about what he can do. Do you think you can really apply the lessons of the past to the present?
Yeah, I think you can apply them, but I think you have to apply them judiciously. History doesn't repeat quite, as more than one eminent scholar has told us. I think he has learned a lot of lessons and will continue to learn. I think he knows he's going to make mistakes. I worry a little bit about this economic team. I don't think they're a creative and bold team willing to stick their necks out. I'd like him to be talking to a wider range of people. But I think I have some faith in Obama more than in his team, actually.
Well, in one of his recent radio and YouTube addresses, Mr. Obama said that the U.S. government would use the help of private contractors to get America working again. Is that something you like? Isn't that what President Bush has been doing?
Yeah, I think that's a good point, Leonard. I think that he does adopt some of the rhetoric of the old style, let's start to call them the old style Democrats of the 1990s. There is nothing inherently wrong with public-private partnerships. I think they can be made to work. But I don't think I think you need to circumscribe them very carefully, like you do most things. And I'd hate to see that be the priority in a time when there are so many darn needs out there.
Have we heard whether the president knows much about John Maynard Keynes?
I don't think we've heard about it. He doesn't talk about it. But it's part of our culture and our language. And, you know, it's part of the thinking of everybody, really, even the conservatives.
Well, what does the choice of economic advisors tell us about his thinking?
Well, I'm a little worried, frankly, about that. Not that I have strong reservations that any of them should not be on the team, but I would like to have seen him choose more broadly. Christina Romer is really an economic conservative. She's not even a centrist Democrat. That seems to have been lost in the media. Larry Summers was very much a deregulationist in the 1970s, at a time when we have to seriously write re-regulation, and we have to keep in mind the Clinton team, led by Bob Rubin, contributed to the current crisis we're in. He's now got to turn colors, so to speak, and I think that's sometimes hard to do. I think he'll be behind the fact. And I think Obama, however, went with the kind of the tried and the safe, and I regret that a little bit. I would have liked him to take more chances.
We were told that Tim Geithner had to be passed because he's the only man who can do the job.
Yeah, well, you know, for a moment I was believing that myself. And then I started to think Geithner was there when this enormous shadow banking system was making all these bad loans, and he didn't say, let's go in and stop that, or let's go in and look at these books aggressively. At least to my knowledge, he didn't. It certainly didn't stop. So I think Tim Geithner, who I think is probably a well-meaning and very bright guy, has lots to learn also.
But the argument for people like Robert Rubin and Lawrence Summers is that they helped create an economic boom in the 1990s.
Well, the sources of that economic boom were very complex, as you well know. There was an increase in the tax rate it's because of President Clinton and his economic team, which helped reduce the budget deficit. But it wasn't the principal cause of the budget deficit reduction. We had an extraordinarily dramatic drop in the price of computer power from 1996 to 1999, which led to the high tech. You know, people put that in highfalutin terms, the new economy and all that, but it was this extraordinary cost drop in the second half of the 1990s, and a variety of other things. Looser policy by Greenspan, who changed his tune, and finally, a speculative boom, which supported all that demand.
So we have been suffering from some of the bubbles that were created then. There was the dot-com bubble
Absolutely.
During the Clinton years, and now we have this mortgage crisis and some of the other deregulation of the banking crises, all bubbles that were created as part of that boom?
I think they were created as part of that boom. There was somewhat the housing bubble was started then, certainly the stock market bubble and the high-tech new economy bubble. It led to people borrowing a lot while the government was running a big surplus, commendably, at least for a while. Private business and consumers were borrowing like crazy to support the economy based on high stock prices.
Wasn't Robert Rubin a strong proponent of overturning the Depression-era Glass-Steagall Act?
Yeah, big-time proponent.
Which many people see as the beginning of a real problem.
I think it was a big part of the problem, but part of the evolution of deregulatory attitudes that began even back in the 1970s when Walter Wriston was running the first national Citibank, which eventually became Citigroup. Big business was overturning regulations all the while, and the Clinton team added on to it, climbed aboard, thought this was the way to go. And the ultimate act was the ending of this Glass-Steagall restriction on the joining of commercial and investment banks.
The national deficit this year is anticipated to be around $1 trillion on top of our already $10 trillion national debt. Do you think Americans that this country can expand the size of government at this time and pay down financial commitments as well?
Well, here is the issue. The issue is there is no perfect solution here. We are going to have a higher deficit as a result of the stimulus, but we would have had a higher deficit anyway as a result of deep recession because it reduces tax revenues. We wouldn't have had as big a deficit, but we would have had a very big deficit with less income for everybody than we will if we have a serious, well-placed stimulus now. So taking on debt now makes sense. It's sad that we already have so much debt we have to add to, but those are the cards we're dealt.
Well, can national debt reach a point where it's at a critical mass where it could threaten to bring down the entire system?
You know, it can, theoretically. I do not think we're quite there. Goldman Sachs economists, I should be clear, issued a report showing that America's debt as a proportion of GDP is somewhere in the middle of the pack. Really? Compared to other
Zimbabwe is worse.
Yeah, right. But I mean, in comparison to rich nations, not all nations, it's still somewhere in the middle of the pack. I don't think we're at a point when you have a $15 trillion economy and the capacities to generate wealth that we can in this country, that we're at a point where we're seriously going to undermine the credibility of the U.S. government.
Some people, including many who worked in the financial industry, have claimed that there was no way anyone could have seen this coming. Do you think that they're being entirely honest?
No. I don't think they're – either they've fooled themselves for so long because there was so much money to be made by fooling yourself, or they're simply not being entirely honest. This – with Wall Street community did not monitor risk – well, the more risk they took, the more risk individuals made in that environment. There were people who warned about it. Even some government agencies in Europe warned about it early on. And it was becoming fairly clear by late 2006, early 2007.
Well, you researched and wrote this book before last summer's financial meltdown, so you must have had a sense that something was coming. Do you wish that you'd waited just a little longer so that you could have included the time when everything hit the fan?
Well, if I had two wishes, the first wish is that it came out earlier so that I would have looked utterly prescient that we needed a big government. But no, I don't think I wish we came out, that we should have come out later. It was very hard to anticipate the credit crisis. It was hard to imagine Wall Street professionals would take on so much risk and borrow, not only buy inflated assets, but borrow aggressively to do so. It was hard to imagine they could be that foolish. We now know.
In Congress, one of the provisions that was proposed for giving money to the auto industry was that the union contracts would be pretty much eliminated. You seem to be arguing for stronger unions at a time when everybody else is saying the unions are at fault for many of our problems.
Is everybody still saying that? I think that's changing
Because of the built-in expenses, health and pension plans and the like.
Well, the auto unions are a special case, not even because of the pensions, but because of all those promised health care benefits for retirees. So that's really a special case. But I think it's pretty clear that economics alone does not determine free market economics alone does not determine your value at the workplace. There is a power relationship, and we've got to start recognizing that. And I think unions help rebalance power. Are unions perfect like everything else I talk about? No.
In 10 seconds or less, can we just print more money as they did during the Weimar Republic?
I don't think we can print any more money. Interest rates are already zero. We're running out of monetary gas. That's why we need fiscal stimulus, especially now.
Fiscal stimulus, which means building things and giving people money as for salaries.
The nice thing is it can mean building things and building our future.
Jeff Madrick, who is a former columnist for the New York Times, a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books and editor of Challenge Magazine, also a senior fellow at the New School's Schwartz Center for Economic Policy Analysis. His book, The Case for Big Government, which is published by Princeton University Press. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, it was really a pleasure. Thanks for having me. Nice to see you, Leonard.